Have you heard Crime and Justice Radio? You should. Monday night, 6 o'clock. And another edition awaits. Bruce Barquette and Aida Leisenring are at the helm. And they're seasoned pros at this, only four or five shows in. And we say a very good morning. It is great to have you, Mr. Barquette. We got Aida, too?
We have both of us today. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
Couldn't have one without you. By the way, I did a great job. You know, if Barquette takes off or continues to take off, and you got guys like Marty Tankliff, you're not going to go wrong. That was an interesting show last week. It really was. Great job, as always.
You. He did a fantastic job. Hard shoes to fill, Bruce's, but he managed.
Bruce in good hands last week, no question. That was an interesting one. The show's been going really good. You've had a great run. I love the former Warden interview a couple of weeks ago, too, with Ron McAndrew. But that was a great show. You've had a couple of good ones. What do you got in store tonight for the folks?
Well, if you liked Ron McAndrew, you're going to love Jennifer Thompson. Jennifer is a rape survivor whose views on the criminal justice system are just mind-blowing. She has established a group in North Carolina called Healing Justice. She deals with the trauma of wrongful convictions and the trauma to victims of wrongful convictions. Her story is that the person that was originally arrested and convicted of raping her, the innocent, Ronald Cotton, and they arrested 12 years later, arrested and convicted another individual, Bobby Plank, who actually committed the rape. And from that trauma of hers, the rape and then the exoneration and the aftermath, she has become a national leader in criminal justice reform.
And that's a good one. That's tonight. You got another good one lined up tonight at 6 o'clock, in which Bruce and Aida will give you some great inside type of looks and everything else that they've been doing for the last 4 or 5 weeks. Now, let me ask both of you a couple of things here. In the last couple of days, you had Derek Chauvin and the three other officers involved with the death of George Floyd. They were indicted. Federal grand jury. It was Friday. The charges they violated is civil rights. So I think it's a 3-count indictment. We'll start with you, Aida. I mean, you knew that this was coming. Now, you have these other officers are going to face their own trial in August. You also have the sentencing of Judge Cahill. That's going to happen in the next 5 to 6 weeks. So, in essence, any surprise here regarding civil rights charges now being brought upon these four? What's your thought process?
Well, I was surprised and at the same time not surprised. It doesn't happen frequently, but every now and then there'll be a federal indictment on an allegation that's been tried or being tried by state court. And a lot of lay people say, isn't that double jeopardy? It's not. It's not at all. And they can do that. But what's really surprising here, and I think it surprised both Bruce and I, is that the charges that Derek Chauvin faces in the federal count can result in a lifetime imprisonment. And I don't think they're seeking the death penalty, but if you read the actual statute, it is punishable by the death penalty as well. So that is shocking. So even if he got a sentence in state court that was consistent with other similarly situated people that were convicted of unintentional murder, and say he gets 12 years, which many people doubt he's going to get. They think he's going to get more. He faces up to 40. But let's just assume he gets 12 years. Then he can be tried and convicted in federal court and still get life imprisonment. And even if his state court claim is successfully appealed and overturned, he will have the federal count over his head nonetheless.
Gotcha. Bruce, your take on this as far as the civil rights situation with these four?
It was an obvious charge. In some ways, I wondered why that wasn't brought initially. But it goes back to what I've been saying all along. This individual, and it may be deserved, maybe deserved. There is certainly strong evidence that he used excessive force. This individual, Chauvin, is never going to see the light of day again. He will spend the rest of his life in prison. The other officers involved, one of whom was a rookie, barely on the force for a couple of months, is now facing federal civil rights charges for which he can get life in prison. It is and it's doubtful that the rookie who didn't touch Mr. Floyd at the point of Mr. Floyd's death is going to end up in a federal prison someplace. It'll be more interesting, I think, to see what happens to these other officers rather than Chauvin. They're not the ones with the knee on the neck. The federal indictment charges them with not willfully not assisting Mr. Floyd. So that's going to be a tough theory, I think, for the federal prosecutors to prove that they had an obligation, failing which it's a federal crime, not to intercede with the senior officer who was effecting an arrest.
And you also have the caveat here where Eric Nelson, the attorney for Chauvin, you know, he's saying, you know what, we have a violation here as far as the jury is concerned. Listen, everybody's seen the photo of one juror as far as the T-shirt was concerned, Black Lives Matter T-shirt or thereabouts, you know, the saying and everything else. So, in essence, you know, you're going to have thinking here regarding Judge Cahill as far as any ammunition here that he will receive. You know he's going to receive plenty. Do you think he's going to stand firm, Aida, as far as everything is concerned? I mean, do you firmly believe that this thing is set in stone? And Bruce has been saying all along he's never going to see the light of day, Chauvin, and everything else. I tend to agree with him. But are you in that type of corner as well, as far as now new information coming out and everything else? Could Cahill, you know, maybe do a little bit of a turnaround here, or do you feel it is firmly in place as well?
No, Cahill's not going to turn around. And we've seen this before, and it's extremely aggravating, especially if you're a defense lawyer, when you select a juror who told you one thing that's provably and objectively false, and it's corroborated by other evidence. And it goes to the heart of the issue. Here, he indicated he wasn't really involved with Black Lives Matter. He respected the group. He wasn't involved in protests, and he could keep an open mind. And lo and behold, we see him wearing a Black Lives Matter T-shirt at a protest specifically for George Floyd. So that would aggravate me as a defense lawyer. But we saw this with Harvey Weinstein. One of the jurors said she, you know, wasn't really obsessed or thought much of the Me Too movement. And lo and behold, she's publishing a book about a Me Too type narrative in which a younger woman gets psychologically coerced into a sexual romantic relationship with an older, wealthier, powerful individual. And guess what? The judge didn't overturn the matter in that case either. So I won't be surprised at all if nothing happens. But is it the right thing to do? Not necessarily.
Bruce and Aida with us. Don't forget their show tonight, 6 to 7. Bruce, I'm going to hit you with something. I brought it up to you last week where you're getting some of these more revelations regarding how Tom Spoda went about his business. And the most alarming part of it was how he handled, along with his little ring over there, the former county executive in Steve Levy. A lot of pressure. They wanted him out. Meanwhile, you got a sentencing looming large here, June 30th, Joan Azarek presiding. So in essence, you know, you have a lot of interesting components now as, you know, we're about six weeks away from an Azarek sentencing here. What role does this new information in your mindset play into what could happen in the next 6 weeks or so regarding Azarek, Spoda, McPartland, a la Burke as well here?
There's two parts to it, right? It's the flavor of the case, and one. And two, what legally or technically a judge can consider. So the flavor of the case really is that intangible thing that you want to see the person get a lot of time or a little time, kind of like George Floyd and Chauvin. Chauvin's going to spend the rest of his life in jail because that's the nature, that's the flavor of the case. How you justify it is something else. With respect to Spoda, the flavor of the case is getting a lot worse for him. Technically, the judge is going to be very careful about what it is that they want to will use to justify giving Spota time. So she'll look at all the information that the prosecutors provide her and then say, well, I'm going to consider just this, this, and this. And the argument by Larry Gatz and the other federal prosecutors for more than the guideline range included really nothing about Levy or other acts other than what Spota and McPartland were tried and convicted for. They essentially argued that the acts that they committed, because of the positions of public trust, because of the abuse of power, because of what they did, justified an 8-year sentence instead of roughly a 5-year sentence. And I think you'll see the judge do basically that. She will not use the flavor of the case explicitly, just use what he was convicted of and sentence him accordingly. But that flavor, that intangible, that kind of taint leaks in and it ends up driving a case. And it's tough as a defense attorney because you can't get your hands around it, right? The judge is going to say, well, I'm not going to consider that. But we all know that she's absolutely looking at it. It absolutely changes her view of Spota and everybody else. That's how I think it will end up playing out.
Yeah, very interesting set of events to take place. And we also keep an eye on the whole Mangano thing as well. Aida, you know, the former county exec and his wife and the Harendra Singh and that whole aspect as far as the county is concerned, the bribes and everything else. You know, you saw more testimony from Singh. You wonder if everything will kind of be set in stone and everything else regarding this particular case and the end of it all there. So you got a lot of caveats happening with this Mangano case as well, Aida.
Yeah, what we're seeing more of, and it's certainly covered in the news more, is accountability for people in power. And it really has become public enemy number one. We're prosecuting all those in power. In fact, Isabel Kirshner, who's an attorney, recently wrote an op-ed about how the wealthy individual is now the most vulnerable to allegations, and in some cases false allegations, but in federal prosecutions, definitely the evidence tends to be overwhelming. So we'll see who's next, but it hasn't stopped. It's become a tidal wave of indictments, and it doesn't seem to be going away for any time soon.
I need Bruce with us there. Sean, I'm going to pick your brain one more thing, guys, and that is, you know, something that bothered many regarding Sheldon Silver, the disgraced ex-state assembly speaker Shelley Silva, will be sent back to prison. A lot of people are scratching their heads over this one. He was, I guess, allowed back home on furlough, which surprised a lot of people. Bruce, I'll start with you. I mean, 8 months into a more than one, a 6-year deal, I think he had. So on furlough while deciding, I guess, if he could serve the remainder of his time in home confinement. A lot of backlash here. What kind of thinking is put into that, knowing the nature of this offense and everything else? I mean, I couldn't figure it out. Was it a leniency thing here? What was the nature of it all regarding Shelley Silver, Bruce?
It's odd because Dean Skelos, who was convicted similarly, also has been released. He's been out for almost a year now. And then it came time for Mr. Silver to go in. He went in and has been in for several months, and he was furloughed. And I think what hurt him, frankly, was the publicity. This is kind of I don't want to say it's routine because it's certainly not, doesn't happen all the time. You have somebody in for a nonviolent offense who is elderly, who very well could die in prison just because of the nature of prison conditions. And the judge who sentenced Mr. Silver did not intend to give him a life sentence. He didn't intend for Mr. Silver to die in prison, even the amount of time that he thought was justified. But because of Silver's age and physical condition and the conditions in jail, it might end up being his death. And if you've been around people that have passed away, and we all have, being near them, being the setting in which they die is significant to the individual and significant to their family members. And I've been around, unfortunately, clients who have passed away in jail, and it's horrific for them and for their families. The goal here was to have him serve some kind of punishment, and home confinement obviously is in prison, but it's still not freedom, outside of having served at home so he doesn't die in prison. And that people caught wind of it, made the press, the government opposed it, and it looks like he's going to go back in at least for a while. I don't want to say we should have sympathy for him. He's been convicted of corruption twice. Once it was reversed and he got convicted again. But you still have to take into account the man's age, his physical condition. He should receive some punishment for what he did. He's been disgraced. He's had removed from power and all the rest. I don't want to see him, personally speaking, I don't want to see him die in prison. So I hope he gets out and is able to spend some time with his family before he passes away.
And the other thing I think has rankled many of it is the fact that, you know, Silva did surrender back in August, and he remained free. I think it was almost 5 years while appealing, you know, his convictions on the corruption-related charges. So, you know, a lot of people might look at that as well. You know, listen, this guy was free. He used the system and everything else and whatnot and should get his just desserts there right now. So I guess that is another factor that has definitely ruffled some feathers, I would think, Aida, over the last couple, you know. So, I mean, that's just another interesting component to this thing.
So bail is never intended to be punitive. It often has had that effect. And even though he's charged federally in the state system, we now have bail reform laws that take into account that people charged with nonviolent crimes really ought not have such onerous bail that they can't get out. And so as defense lawyers, we're frequently in this situation where our clients are facing a significant sentence. They haven't been convicted yet. They haven't been tried, but they're out on bail, and that's actually very helpful in their defense and instrumental because we're able to communicate with them more. They're able to give us more contact information, the lay of the land, and help in their own investigation. And it actually makes it more difficult for that individual to then be tried and convicted and sentenced. People don't understand. They're not walking around going, oh, great, I'm getting away with murder. They're thinking, oh, no, any day now, my trial date could be set, I could be convicted, and I could be going to prison. And that kind of psychological burden on the defendant is really true, and it's significant. And it's like, you know, you have people with minor anxiety going to psychologists. This is the worst kind of anxiety someone can have. It affects family. It affects your future decisions. It's a nightmare. It's a living nightmare.
It certainly is, and it appears that way without question. Bruce Barquette, Aida Leisenring, tonight, 6-7, another tremendous edition coming up of Crime and Justice Radio, of course, from the great firm folks, Barquette Epstein, Kieran Aldea, and Loturco, great firm out of Garden City, and we await. We will all be listening tonight at 6. Bruce and Aida, thanks so much for giving us a couple here.
Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jay.